The Babylon Project podcast was our last best hope for reruns. It failed. But in the year of the Shadow War, it became something greater. Our last best hope for fandom. The year is 2017. The place, the Babylon Project podcast.
This is Maggie Egan, your ISN news anchor, and you're listening to the Babylon Project podcast. Thanks for listening.
Hi there, Babylon 5 fans. Welcome to another exciting, and this one will be exciting. This is probably one of the best episodes of the entire series of the Babylon Project podcast. And I'm going to start the exciting off right now. Sorry, Jim, I'm going to give you second dibs here, but I'm going to say hello to JP Harvey first.
Hi, guys.
Primarily because he is going to be a regular co-host on this show, so it's going to be a wonderful three-way discussion from now on. So how are you doing tonight, JP?
I'm doing great, other than coming off the backside of a cold.
Ow. UNF the country, it seems like. And also joining us, as always, is my very good friend, Jim Arewood. How are you, sir?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good.
Well, this is going to be a fun show tonight. We're talking about, I believe, Severed Dreams.
That is correct. 3:10.
And the episode that won them their second Hugo Award for Best Dramatic Presentation. This is a totally amazing piece of work.
Oh, yeah, definitely worthy of a Hugo Award.
Now, knowing that this episode is probably going to run a little long, considering all three of us here, Jim, how about going straight into a recap?
All right.
Archive. Access. Initiated.
The Earth Alliance ship, Alexander, arrives at Babylon 5 for repairs following a huge space battle in which General Haig has been killed. Soon, they are joined by another ship, the Churchill. Both ships have gone rogue and are becoming a resistance movement against President Clark's government. Sheridan gives an order that all communication with Earth be severed, save for the ISN newsfeed. Meanwhile, Mars announces that it will not implement martial law and is attacked by Clark's forces. Other worlds begin declaring independence in protest of Clark's tactics. During a broadcast from ISN, a man breaks in on the normal broadcast to tell the viewers what is actually happening on Earth, and it is at this time that the building that houses ISN is attacked and the service is interrupted. Back at Babylon 5, several Earth Force vessels arrive and tell Sheridan that he is to stand down and that the station will come under the control of forces that are loyal to Clark. Of course, Sheridan refuses, and a battle ensues, pitting the station and the rogue ships against the Earth Force fleet. Just as the battle seems to be lost, Delenn arrives from a visit to the Grey Council in command of the White Star and several Minbari warships. Unwilling to fight the Minbari, the opposing Earth Force vessels depart. Delenn goes to Minbar and admonishes the Grey Council for ignoring prophecy. She makes an appeal to them to behave as they should, and when she leaves, several members of the council leave with her. A Minbari ranger arrives on the station and explains that he has been visiting the non-aligned worlds and has discovered that some have allied themselves with the shadows and have been making war with their neighbors. Well, there it is.
Oh my. That is, and I'm not saying that your commentary was short. It just, when you hear what happens and compare that to the amount of show that is packed into those 40 minutes, it's like, whoa.
Well, yeah, that's for sure.
Almost impossible to summarize this show.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Character files opened.
And like a lot of good shows, especially on Babylon 5, this just starts right out with the guest cast.
Yep. So we start out with Kim Moriori as Sandra Hiroshi, or the captain of the EAS Churchill. Mm-hmm. This is her only appearance on Babylon 5, and she really doesn't have any other credits in the genre to note.
Mm. Now, do you count Ghost Whisperer?
Ghost Whisperer.
She had a TV series. Yeah, that's a TV series that she had a guest appearance on.
Oh, well, see, I don't count Paranormal as science fiction.
Neither do I, which is why I asked.
Okay. Except for X-Files. I will put X-Files in there because there was some science there.
Right.
Okay.
I guess the biggest, her biggest thing that a lot of people might know her from is her somewhat longer run on St. Elsewhere.
Wow. Yeah, that's been a while. I don't remember that.
I lived St. Elsewhere. There, I had no reason to watch the show, So I really didn't see her from that.
Oh, gosh.
What I will say about her, though, is in a lot of ways, well, she was the perfect cast for this, for the role.
Oh, yeah.
And in a lot of ways, in my opinion, she's what sold this episode in some ways.
Yeah. For a guest star, she had a pretty major part.
Right.
It was brief, but it was important.
Yeah, which means she had to sell it the moment she came on screen.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well,
all right, who else do we have?
Well, continuing on, we had Rance Howard as David Sheridan, John's dad.
Right.
He has three appearances on Babylon 5, all as the same character. Tons of credits dating back to 1956, and he was the minister on Apollo 13 when the ship capsule was in trouble. He was a minister sitting next to Jim Lovell's on-screen wife and comforting her as the bad news was coming in from NASA.
Okay.
Yeah. And now, with that mentioned, I can actually picture that.
I got a question about Rance.
Okay.
And I don't know if you would know the answer or not. Is he any relation to Ron?
Don't know. I didn't.
I'm actually thumbing back through his credits real quick just to see who is Ron's brother or cousin?
His brother, Clint Howard.
Clint Howard.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, we got Phil Morris as Bill Traynor. This is his only appearance on Babylon 5. His first television appearance on the original series was in the episode Miri. He was one of the kids.
oh, wow.
Yes. He was in Search for Spock as trainee Foster, who... yeah, and he's the one that asked Kirk if they were going to get the big welcome back to the... to Starfleet after the battle, and Kirk says, what, a hero's welcome? You know, God knows we deserve it. He was in Mission Impossible as Grant Collier, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Men in Black TV series, Terminator, Sarah Connor Chronicles, and he was Miles Dyson in that series. He was on Smallville as John Jones and has done lots and lots of voice work.
Wait, they... had a Men in Black TV series?
Yeah, it didn't last very long.
Why do I think that may not have been a bad thing?
moving on, we have Bruce McGill as Major Ed Ryan, and he was in command of the Clarkstown. Mm-hmm. Interesting name for a ship. And he has credits dating back to 1977, including The Man Who Fell to Earth, a 1987 movie. He was on Quantum Leap, Time Cop, and he had a rather important role in Star Trek Voyager as Captain Braxton from the 29th century. So,
okay, and another person with a very impressive line of credits.
Yes. Yeah, you see him all over the place. We have, under co-starring, we have James Parks as Draken, the Minbari on Lashak. And this is his only appearance on Babylon 5. He will appear, though, in Crusade. He was in Space Above and Beyond, one of my favorite series. Voyager as Vel, X-Files, and on Star Trek Enterprise as Deputy Bennings in the episode called North Star.
Okay.
And he wasn't a very nice character in that episode. And last but not least, Maggie's back.
Yay.
And it'll be a while after this episode before she's back again.
Yep.
There's our cast.
Well, not seeing Maggie is kind of understandable from the circumstances, though.
Yeah.
Initiating plot analysis.
Oh, wow. So with a cast like that, what can I say?
It has to be good.
And it probably starts with madness.
It probably starts with... Yeah.
Yeah. And Londo's the one that's mad.
Yes. He's having a little bit of problem getting home. Odd that he thinks of Babylon 5 as home now. Yeah. Karma can be, what's the word I'm looking for? We want to keep our family rating.
A son of a gun.
Karma can be a son of a gun, can't it?
Oh, yes. Well,
yeah.
You know, though, Londo's rant was really, really great, but the guy he was ranting to was priceless.
He was outstanding.
Yes. Totally. Yeah, and his final comment of madness. Yeah, speaking of madness and humans fighting.
Yeah, that's quite a furball going on.
Yeah, it starts out with a bang. And one of the things I like about, he comes right up and, God, JP, this is going to be an episode where I tend to be a rambler. And with the lag that we get sometimes, you feel free to jump in at any point, okay?
Got it.
But the struggle, the moral struggle and the moral justification of opening fire on your own.
Yeah, there was a lot of setup for this in the last episode.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've got notes to myself to tie back one big theme in particular. So as we move through this episode, I'll harken back to the last episode.
Oh, neat.
That would be great. Yeah. One thing that stood out is Clark's opponents, who we really don't know too much about yet. They seem to have a whole lot of conscience, especially about opening fire on their own. Whereas Clark's people that have been stacked into the command positions, much less so.
Yeah, so it would seem. I honestly, I could not imagine it. You know, our own Civil War, we talk about it in history class, we learn about it, we see television shows, but I don't think any of those mediums actually can give a person a feeling of what it would be like to fight people that you know, your friends and neighbors, and you know their wife, you know their kids, you know their families and stuff. I absolutely could not imagine it, and this episode does a really good job of painting that picture.
Yeah, I think it really does. Forced into the situation, forced into the position, though, the Alexander does what it has to do to protect itself, to protect its people.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, they are coming to Babylon 5, and hell is riding in their wake.
Yeah, that's what Sheridan says.
Mm-hmm. Sheridan in particular, his goal at this point still, he's trying to avoid the fight. He's just trying to buy time for the situation to be resolved.
Mm-hmm.
We get a short cut to Franklin and Delenn. There's a injured Mibari that apparently has some very vital intelligence for Delenn.
Mm-hmm.
Something nasty happening in the League worlds.
Yeah, and notice who comes to help out.
Yep. Jakar seems to be pretty good at finding out what's going on this station.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, he just walks in, snatches up that Minbari, says, I know the way through the Narn guards, and let's go.
Right, I can get him there.
Yep.
Yeah, I'll carry him as long as you need me to.
And oddly enough, I suspect his path might actually be right in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume some of his knowledge or his kind of his informal authority comes from the fact that the Narn are participants in station security.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And like I said, he's probably the one person who can walk across in front of them. And in this situation, they wouldn't see a thing.
Well, they're loyal to him. You know, he has proven himself, and now he is proving himself to everybody else.
And we get another quick cut again, just setting the stage. We get our first appearance by Maggie.
Yay.
Mars will not implement martial law.
Yeah.
Mars has a bit of a history of being a bit of a thorn in Earth's side.
Yeah.
But Clark's declarations are being claimed as unconstitutional. You know, I'm going to go back to something that I know we've talked about in the past, and I've done some checkup on this, and I'm pretty sure that the Earth Alliance system is not so much of a constitutional republic as we understand it and work with here in America as it is a parliamentarian system.
Mm.
Hence, they have just the single Senate instead of the two houses of their legislature.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure it's more of a parliamentarian system.
Now, we really haven't learned how the government is selected, have we?
No.
No.
No. So I don't know if the senators are elected, appointed.
Except that the president is elected by a popular vote.
Okay. But beyond that.
We learned that in season one.
Beyond that, we don't know.
Mm-hmm. But Mars is not going to implement martial law, which is almost a challenge to Clark to do something about it.
There will be hell to pay for that.
Yeah.
But, you know, Mars has been all along just below the surface making mm-hmm. noises of breaking off and becoming independent.
Right.
Well, those were small steps. This one was a giant leap.
Yeah. One could question whether or not this was opportunism on Mars's part.
Mm-hmm.
But when we see the follow-up actions here, and we see actions from the other colonies, and Clark's response, I kind of think it transcends opportunism. If nothing else, it certainly gives Mars the moral high ground. Sheridan, when he drops the bomb on the command crew, he makes it clear they are giving humanitarian aid.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So basically, he's still not at the point of rebellion yet.
Yeah, it's humanitarian aid for the time being.
My impression last episode and up to this point in this episode was Sheridan, he could see all of the potential ugly that could happen, but for the most part, none of it has happened. So he strikes me as, in front of his crew anyway, reserving judgment and keeping that to himself. Or maybe to the inner circle there, you know, the top echelons of his command crew. But he's not openly speculating about the worst. He's watching and hoping that it's not the worst, but gets that it could happen. And then we'll see events unfold that change the way he dialogues with his crew.
Yeah. He's never struck me as a hothead anyway.
No.
I think he's making really good choices.
Right.
And like the quite a few military folks that I've known in the past in my life, he seems, his goal, it seems to be more of a political solution rather than a military one, for rather obvious reasons. Mm-hmm.
Gets it from his dad.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, wouldn't there be, even if it is humanitarian aid he is offering to the Alexander JP, do you think there's still going to be ramifications? I mean, we've started down a path here maybe that there's no turning back from.
Right. Yeah, there would be, you know, I think he's playing two sides of a coin here. When he says we're offering humanitarian assistance, that's, he's playing the military head of a diplomatic station. Mm. But at the same time, he's still a military officer having sworn an oath to the earth. So there's that dilemma that if there's a technical facet of this that says that there's a warship that's in defiance of lawful orders and that they come to Babylon 5, he's probably at a crisis, a personal crisis that he has to work through. Yeah. Am I the head of a diplomatic station or am I a military officer? And he's taking the, I guess in some sense, the more conservative, the less dramatic side.
Yeah.
Again, I think waiting to see what actually happens versus what he thinks might be happening or what he assumes could be the worst case. And he'll deal with the consequences later.
Yeah, and if you think about it, he's following precedent that he's established already. He's dealt with the Narn in a similar fashion.
Yeah. Anytime there's a distress call, though, I believe Earth ships, and I think it's true today, if you receive a distress call, you are obligated to render aid if possible.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So he's following the regs.
Here's the unknown, and it goes back to the comical beginning of the show. When Londo is upset at the madness and all of this is because the humans are fighting. The humans are fighting, but all of those other races, those other species that are on the station aren't involved in the fight. So Sheridan may have what he believes to be an obligation as the diplomatic administrator of the station to represent or to lead or govern or, you know, we can pick the right word, all of that and not just the interests of humanity. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, when he says, just like he did with the Narn, I'm going to provide humanitarian aid, you're right. It's not out of line. The other piece of this is we don't know what the Alexander, he doesn't know, I'll say, what the Alexander is doing. So it's coming to Babylon 5. Have they removed themselves from combat, essentially surrendering? Probably not the right technical term, but have they removed themselves from combat, or are they coming back? Are they retreating, reconstituting and going back in? And until Sheridan knows what they're doing, he's, again, I think, erring on the side of caution.
Hmm.
And you know, there's a third point, a third angle to this as well, with what you, the point you make as far as being a military governor of a outpost. That outpost is also effectively the United Nations of space, and in a way he's almost not quite, because like I said, he is a military governor, but you can certainly draw some equivalence between him and, say, the Secretary General,
right,
of the UN. So he's got obligations in that regard as well.
And then on the other side of the same coin, we have Clark, who has established himself clearly as being anti-alien.
Right.
And he's not going to care what Sheridan has done. He's going to come with his claws bared.
Except, of course, for his backdoor dealings and arrangements with some of the worst of the aliens in space.
Well, that's...
meaning the Shadows, yeah. Not necessarily the Centauri.
Well, that's because they advance his position.
Right. Clark's anti-alienism is pretty much an excuse.
As soon as he figures he can get the upper hand, that'll come to an end, too.
So this humanitarian argument is risky. You know, as we just discussed, Babylon 5, you could argue correctly, is in defiance. But you could also argue that they're not. Mm-hmm. Right. And Sheridan, when he talks to the bridge crew there, the command center crew, this declaration of rendering humanitarian aid is a part of a bigger speech that's pretty important, because he cites why he's taking that position. And I get the impression, by the way, too, this isn't a lazy guy, not that anyone who watches the show would think he is. He's not looking for the easy way out. I think he's looking for the best possible way out, and probably no way out is really a good way. Mm-hmm. So he's worked through this in his own mind, decided what he thinks is the right thing to do, and now he's giving this first announcement to the bridge crew to say, here's what we're doing. And as I recall, he said, I've talked to Ivanova about this.
And here's my legal justification.
Right. And he explains himself as the commander. He says, this is the direction we're going to go. And then he gives an option. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He gives an option to the crew, the bridge crew, the command crew.
Yeah.
Now, switching on, it's not just Sheridan having a bad day. The report to Dillon, in medbay. Jim alluded to this already, that the shadows are making alliances with the different worlds in the League. So they've got alliances with the Centauri. They've got alliances with Earth, though no one knows about that. And they're stirring the pot with the League. Basically, they're playing all sides. They've got something going on with every major race, except it seems the Narn, who are pretty much crushed. They're no longer a political entity. Mm-hmm. And the Membari, which it would seem that they know better. Or do they have something with the Membari? Yeah. We'll come back to that a little bit later, both in the series and in this particular episode.
Ah.
But they seem to be intent on sowing chaos. That seems to be their objective. As to what the reason is, who knows?
Well, what better way to get an upper hand than to create a situation to take everybody's attention away from what they're doing?
Mm-hmm. And what's important about this conversation with this intel is, what is the government of Minbar doing?
Nothing.
What are they not doing?
Yeah.
They're doing nothing.
They are trying to stay out of it for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do find out, Alexander arrives. We do find out a little bit of information. I know when I was watching this episode the first time through, everyone had been so excited because they've been talking about General Haig. Everyone was hoping to see, it's like, where's General Haig? When are we going to see something more with him? And then we find out he was killed by Deep Space Nine.
What?
He couldn't make the show for the filming of this episode.
Oh.
There was a scheduling conflict.
Oh, I see.
So the joke at the time was General Haig was killed by DS9.
Oh, geez.
But Major Ryan takes over in that position. It was a clean way to take him out. That in particular, he was killed in that shot that hit amidships on the Alexander.
Okay.
But it turns out that the people are being led as sheep back home. It brings to mind Benjamin Franklin's quote about trading liberty for security.
Yeah.
And deserving neither. Well, that is the perfect way to build a coup. And Clark is very clearly taking advantage of that.
Oh, yeah. Well, and he's going to try to control the spin, too, and make sure that all of these events that are happening are going to be renegades that are mm-hmm. doing it, you know.
Control information, control speech.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, at least in the U.S. system, the First Amendment is the First Amendment.
Yep.
And then we find out the real bomb is that Mars is being bombed by Earth. Specifically, Earth is bombing Mars civilians.
What a grim scene that is.
Yeah. Yeah, especially, it's not even a matter of Mars trying to use human shields. He's just openly attacking Mars Dome.
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah. And then one thing that kind of baffled me is you have the fighter pilots or the bomber pilots flying over Mars, and they're picking up transmissions from Mars's surface from civilians saying, hey, we got kids down here. Please don't do this. That seemed a little strange to me.
I think there's too much story for JMS to develop that, but you're right.
Yeah.
It would be odd if Mars was in open defiance and attacking Earth forces, that the Earth would turn around and attack Martian cities. That's just a strange construct. And I suspect that they did that in the show just to make it clear quickly that Clark is wicked.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't a misunderstanding. It's not that we as viewers get to see two perspectives and one looks horrible up front, but later we're going to learn he was right all along. They've made it abundantly clear. Clark is bad.
Yeah.
And that was probably the best way to do it.
Oh, yeah.
And remember, they were in defiance, but Mars had not initiated any sort of military action.
Right. We hear that they are not going to institute or implement martial law. And the next thing we hear about Mars is being bombed.
Mm-hmm.
So Mars appears to take a passive resistance to this. Look, we're over here. We're just going to stay out of the way. We're not going to implement martial law. We're just going to stand here and kind of watch you work this out.
Right.
And it's not lost on me. You guys brought it up before that there is a historic friction between Earth and Mars in the series. But all we know is we're not going to institute or implement martial law. And the next thing that happens is cities are bombed.
Yeah.
That's pretty dramatic. It's not Earth put different forces on Mars to enforce the martial law. They just bomb cities.
Right.
Yeah, that's evil. Evil.
And, you know, I think, JP, you're onto something else with this, too. It's a matter of building the case of the kind of people that Clark has been putting into military positions, the kind of people he's been placing since the beginning of the series, essentially.
Right.
To just do this and eliminating or removing people that would oppose him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, in fact, there's a contrast here back in the speech to the bridge crew when Sheridan explains himself. He cites that he's taking the position he takes because what Clark is doing is unconstitutional.
Uh-huh.
So you have one guy saying, I'm going to take a particular view on this because of the Constitution. And then you get another guy, we don't know the details of their Constitution, who is responding to...
But we do know that they have suspended a lot of elements of the Constitution.
Right. Yep.
Rights of assembly, rights of speech, we know at least, at the very least, have been suspended.
So if B5 essentially says we're not going to play by these new rules, and he tells his bridge crew that, and then they watch the government of Mars say we're not going to play by these new rules, and they watch Mars get bombed, what does that tell us about what's coming?
Yeah, exactly.
And, of course, that's exactly the message Clark's trying to send.
Right.
Delenn has got her own problems. She's managing to get out of the station to go to the Great Council. And I like her conversation with Jakar. She's definitely warming to Jakar, and I see that, and I think back to the pilot series where she pulls out that ring and is basically threatening Jakar with the, you cross me again the wrong way, and I will kill you.
Oh, she just about twists his head off in that scene.
Yeah.
I think based on her comment before she leaves, she was thinking back to that same episode.
Yeah.
If you remember, and I think her comment, and I wrote it down here, I'm happy to share it now if you want, but her comment, it may be one of the most important statements in the episode because it ties lots, if not all, of the seasons together. And the comment was, Jakar, you're not quite the same person I met years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that statement, as we've just discussed, goes all the way back to early in season one. And we're going to see the truth of that play out in the next few seasons until the end of the show.
Uh-huh.
So I love, that's my favorite line other than maybe one other that I'm sure you guys know is coming. Yeah. That may be my favorite line in the episode. She utters that line and then goes off to do her duty.
If nothing else, you may be right. It may be one of the most important lines, especially when you consider how the Jakar-Londo relationship is so central to the entire series. And in contrast with the line in the pilot that no one is who they seem.
Right.
Well, Jakar is becoming who he seems now.
And a new visitor arrives, right?
Yes, another ship, the Churchill.
Yes.
Commanded by Captain Hiroshi. By the way, you notice Captain Hiroshi, Captain Sheridan, Major Ryan, which kind of has me scratching my head as far as the military command structure for Earth Force vessels are concerned. But we've had that discussion back in, I guess, season one. So,
yeah,
folks, if you haven't gone through the old podcast, pull up and listen to season one. I don't remember exactly which episode.
It is confusing. I mean, are we using naval ranks? Are we using more of the infantry rank? You know, what are we doing here?
Especially when Susan's rank is commander.
Well, that would be Navy, and I don't have a big problem accepting that, but someone in command of a ship being called major, that is a little confusing.
And if he was a Marine, I guess, to use the modern construct, and on board a ship, of course, the general was, Haig was a general, right? Not an admiral. We don't really get to know why some ships are commanded by captains, and I assume that those are not only the person's rank, but also their title. The captain of a ship can be a major, but it's unusual to have a not naval rank suddenly commanding a ship when it seems most of the others that we see are kind of follow the naval construct. So we have a captain, meaning a colonel equivalent, in command of a vessel, also making him a captain, the captain, functionally. But I thought it was interesting that the general dies and apparently all his colonels and such died too, because we went from a general to a major. I didn't question it. I just let it slip. But I thought that was a bit odd that there weren't other senior officers between the major and the general.
I think I may have an explanation that just popped into my head. First of all, you notice on one side, there are no admirals. The top rank across the board and across the entire chief of staffs is general. But considering the nature of Haig being on the run, if Ryan was his aide or attaché, taking command from that perspective, perhaps. And I know it's flimsy, but
yeah, it would be different than how it would happen here. But I forgave it, or I just let it go based on the need to tell the story. Yeah, a general officer's aide or a colonel's aide or adjutant wouldn't assume the general's responsibilities, right? They're an aide. They're not in the command chain.
Right. And considering Captain Hiroshi, who I'd mentioned coming in, that really makes you willing to forgive. Like you had noted, she is not on, and my wife mentioned this as well, she's not on screen for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And her role is so important that you have to be invested in her, not just as a walk-in, but you have to be invested in her as in a personal level the moment she walks onto the screen.
She's a huge impact.
Yeah, because what happens, she's a lot of the emotional pull of this episode. It's her story in those few moments that she's on the screen that is the part that'll bring you to tears. And this is just her first moment, and she's not even on screen. She's on screen on a screen.
Yes.
Saying that she's going to come over. Clark has declared that the Mars bombings will continue until Mars surrenders. Mm-hmm. It's not even a matter of submitting to martial law now. It's Mars surrendering outright. It's getting scary, and Maggie gets interrupted.
Guy comes running in and sits down with a microphone, and it's really neat because Jane, we we keep calling her Maggie, but her character was Jane. Jane is not real right. happy about the way this is being done.
Well, yeah, and it's she's wanting to try and stay on the air.
Right. It's a service that's going to be needed, but in its current form. But this guy, he's going to bring down the house.
Yeah. Well, this guy makes it clear. It's like, no, they're already on their way over to shut us down.
Ah.
This is our only chance to get any word out. And the word in this case is that Orion and Proxima 3 are breaking away, that they've declared independence as well based on the bombing of Martian civilians. And I think you've got a clip from Maggie. We did an interview some time ago, Jim did at least, with Maggie Egan, and you have something interesting about this piece.
Yes, I specifically asked her about this scene on this episode, and here's what she had to say.
Excuse me. When you were an ISN anchor, in the episode called, this is for the benefit of our listeners, Severed Dreams.
Right.
The studio was attacked.
Right.
It looked scary. Was that a scary scene to film?
It was, in that, you know, there is no rehearsal for, you know, having all that scenery drop on you. Right. You know, it's just like, okay, we're going to do the scene, and then Maggie, things will be dropping. Okay. And you're just like, whatever. By the way, just a little aside, they never knew this, but at the time I was probably about 4 months pregnant, and I didn't tell them because I wanted my job, you know? And I thought, I don't know that they would let me do this if they knew I was pregnant, so I kept my mouth shut. But yes, when that studio started falling, I mean, I wasn't acting anymore. It was just like, ah! I was dodging the scenery. It made it real, though. It, you know, there was no having to think about, you know, how do I portray this? No, you're just in reaction mode. So it was great. I loved it. Let me tell you, it made it easy.
It looked scary, and it didn't look fake at all.
It wasn't. But they do know how to avoid your head, so that's good. They make it look very real with skilled people, I'm assuming, who know how to make things fall around you and not on you. So,
if you listen to Joe Straczynski's commentary, he makes a comment about the stuff was supposed to be a little more in front of them and a lot less on top of them.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and, you know, if you watch that scene of her, when that first thing, when those first pieces come down, she is startled. I mean, she jumps.
Yeah. And folks, you got to listen. If you've got the DVDs, listen to Joe Straczynski's commentary on this episode. It's one of the ones that have it. It's great. But yeah, her reaction was not a faked reaction.
No.
But we find out Captain Hiroshi is providing an update. Clark knows about Babylon 5, what's been going on there. And part of the reason she came to Babylon 5 was to carry the message that there are ships coming on the way to take over Babylon 5, so it doesn't follow the example of Orion or Proxima 3, or Mars in that case.
Mm-hmm.
But in particular, it's not just that they know the Alexander is there. They were on the way to Babylon 5 to arrest and get rid of the command crew anyway.
I think that that ties us back to the last episode, too, or earlier episodes. And the first time I saw this, I thought, Well, there you have it. We've seen what's going on with Mars and with Earth, and we know as viewers about the high likelihood, or we could take it as fact, that this was a coup. And now there's a warship taking refuge at Babylon 5. Sorry, Babylon 5, we're taking you out next. But I think it also traces back to the leadership decision to remove Night Watch, which we learned back at the beginning of this episode was a part of the way that Clark seized control, was by having his people, his loyalists, in key positions, and Night Watch is mentioned.
It is?
So it is, yes.
It
so
is.
Now you go, oh, wait a minute, it wasn't just, this is going to cause a ripple in the pond when Night Watch is removed from being the security force at Babylon 5, we now see that Clark would view that as a direct threat.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a lot of ways, when you look at these last couple of episodes, just following up on it, a lot of Sheridan's actions were based on his belief or his justification that it's Clark that is actually staging the coup. He might have been the elected president, but he's abused his power to the point where he's right. actually executing a coup. And that's his justification for violating orders. He's placing his oath to the Constitution above his obligation to follow the chain of command.
Well, he obviously thinks he's above the law, and he was not duly elected. He succeeded Santiago.
True.
Yeah.
There's no really appeal to other worlds, going back to the UN concept here, because of the amount of chaos that the shadows have sown everywhere else. They're too busy fighting each other, it seems. Mm-hmm. And in a way, you know, he's come to the realization his approach up to this point has, as JP kind of indicated, and I've mentioned, it's a political solution, looking for a political solution or to buy time. And there's no more buying time. This is their last stand. And basically, he's seeing it as a position of fight or surrender.
Mm-hmm.
And in either case, Clark's shown a willingness to kill innocent.
Yeah. And in this scene was some of what I thought was some really great camera work, because as he is being told what is going to happen, the camera, I mean, they do this effect, and I don't know how they do it or what it's called, but they kind of focus on him and pull him forward while the rest of the, while the background moves back. I don't know how they do it.
Joe described that before, and apparently it's not an easy maneuver to do, but you pull the camera back physically while you zoom in on the character.
Oh, I see. Well, I mean, you know, you could just see there he's sitting there, the cat that ate the canary.
Yeah.
And now it's going to be time to pay.
And, you know, in this discussion, we've talked about Hiroshi's report. You've got Hiroshi's report, I think.
Yeah, I do.
We've talked about the presence and how well she sells herself. I think her commentary here is important to include.
Okay.
Major Ryan, Captain, we just jumped in from Orion 7. They've declared independence.
We've heard. What's the reaction?
Clark's afraid of losing the other colonies, so he's sending his elite forces to seize direct control of any colony or outpost that might move against him.
If he finds out we're here...
It's too late. He already knows. We intercepted attack orders relayed to the Agrippa and the Roanoke. They're hooking up with some heavy reinforcements on the way in.
We better pull out before we jeopardize Babylon 5 further.
Major, the ships receiving the attack order were already on their way here. He doesn't want to risk Babylon 5 breaking away. So those ships are under orders to seize command of Babylon 5, arrest and detain its captain and the rest of the command staff, and to put this station under the direct authority of President Clark and the Night Watch.
The other governments won't stand for it.
They won't intervene. All the major powers are divided, distracted, busy with their own wars. We're on our own.
I'm sorry to be the bearer of such bad news, Captain, but I thought you should know.
And that doesn't even begin to convey the presence she has on screen when she's delivering this.
Oh, yeah, this entire scene is incredible.
And Raul, you mentioned being out of time. I think we get a time frame in this scene, too, right? How much time does Sheridan have? Do you remember? Once they know the ships are coming. Yeah, 6 hours. So all of the time buying and all of the time that has passed over the last several episodes, we're now down to... He has 6 hours to decide what he's going to do. Truly. There's no maneuver room left at this point.
Well, actually, it's not even 6 hours to decide what he's going to do. He's going to have to decide now, because one way or another, he's going to have to use that 6 hours to prepare, because it's pretty clear that with the approach that they're taking, Clark's forces are going to come in shooting.
Well, in the scene where they isolated him on camera, he did a great job of sitting there and looking like, holy moly, what am I going to do now? What am I going to do now? I mean, and you heard the other voices kind of fading in the background, the music swelling a little bit, and Sheridan, he's by himself. In a room full of people, he is by himself.
And it's not just as a military commander that he's having to make this decision. It's as the governor of a quarter of a million civilians.
Yes, he's got a big responsibility.
And I guess this would be a perfect point. His monologue on this, well, play it. It stands on its own.
I know we were all hoping to avoid a head-on confrontation with Earth, that somehow we could stop this train before it went off track. But this train is heading right for us, and there is not a lot of time. So we have only two options. We fight, or we surrender. If it was just us, hey, he pays your money, he takes your chances, but it's not just us. It's a quarter million people here and billions more out there counting on us. Now, I promised Delenn that we would draw a line against the darkness no matter the cost. Well, now we know the cost. There's too much at stake to walk away now.
If we surrender, they'll court-martial us. If we fight and lose, they'll probably kill us.
They probably will at that. So the choice is yours.
I say fight.
Fight?
Fight. Fight.
And we see what they will be fighting, and that is a big armada.
Oh, more. Yeah.
Do you like Sheridan's line? I don't know if that was, I assume that was written that way on purpose to mean multiple things. I promised Delenn I would draw a line against the darkness.
Mm-hmm.
Not against an unconstitutional military, not against Earth. So, yet one more little, we're drawing a line against right and wrong, and we'll call wrong the darkness, but there's the bigger picture of the story, too.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, hanging over all of this is still the threat of the shadows.
Morden, they know Morden is in with Clark, remember?
Yeah.
That so they know this is not just against Clark, it is against the Shadow Ward. JP is absolutely right pointing that
and
out.
I think that lets us, I'm sorry, Jim.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think that, you know, Clark is kind of a small cog in the wheel, actually. He has power over Earth and everything, but as far as the shadows are concerned, Clark is going to dump them when he figures he has enough of an upper hand.
At least that's what he thinks.
But he will get brushed aside very, very easily if Clark gets Babylon 5 out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they will swat Clark like nothing.
Yeah. Well, moving on to planning the fight, I'm glad they address it. It's a little weak, but what's Drawl's role with the Great Machine going to be with this kind of a battle coming? And Sheridan's saving him.
Yeah.
However, he does want to borrow his holographic system, you know, that little projector that lets him pop up anywhere for a special announcement, which we will come to shortly, because in the meantime, we have a very, to use Babylon 5's phrase, a very honked off Delenn.
I'll tell you what. This is one of the best Delenn scenes. I would equate it to Ivanova's I am the right hand of God monologue.
I will tear the station apart until I find them.
Yes.
With my bare hands. Uh-huh. Yeah. Frankly, actually, this is the best Delenn lines for Delenn. It's taking full advantage of everything that Mira Verlan has to offer.
Uh-huh.
because you get this power line here, and then immediately afterwards, that line fades into the distance because what she does and says addressing the Grey Council.
Mm-hmm.
And you notice with her that angry, it seems that even the Grey Council knows, it's like she gets her audience.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And she talks and they listen. Let's go ahead and play that.
I told you, Delenn, they will not speak to you.
Then they will listen to me. I served the Council for 16 cycles. I was the chosen of Dukat to replace him. I held him when he died. His blood is on my hands, his spirit in my eyes, his word on my lips. You will step aside in his name and mine, or in Balin's name, I will tear this ship apart with my bare hands until I find them. Move aside.
For 3 years, I warned you this day was coming, but you would not listen. Pride, you said. Presumption. And now the shadows are on the move. The Centauri and the younger worlds are at war. The Nars have fallen. Even the humans are fighting one another. The pride was yours. The presumption was yours. For 1,000 years, we have been awaiting the fulfillment of prophecy. And when it finally happens, you scorn it, you reject it, because you no longer believe it yourselves. We stand between the candle and the star, between the darkness and the light. You say the words, but your hearts are empty, your ears close to the truth. You stand for nothing but your own petty interests. Problems of others are not our concern. I do not blame you for standing silent in your shame. You, who knew what was coming, but refused to take up the burden of this war. If the warrior caste will not fight, then the rest of us will. If the Council has lost its way, if it will not lead, if we have abandoned our covenant with Balin, Council should be broken, as was prophesied. We must stand with the others now, before it's too late. Between the worker caste and the religious caste, we control 2/3 of our forces. And to you, I say, listen to the voice of your conscience. Break the Council and come with me. Our time of isolation is over. We move now, together, or not at all.
And they move.
Well, everyone except the warrior caste.
Yeah, you know, do you think maybe they were just thinking that if they just stay out of it, everybody will destroy everybody else, and they'll come out on top without having to lift a finger?
Or perhaps they have a better reason to not participate as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, after all, there's some external support behind President Clark.
Yeah.
That's a good question to keep in mind for later in the series, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Something about that piece that you just played, except for the actual breaking of the staff, the point where she breaks it, up to that point, that is one single continuous take.
Yeah, there weren't
of intense monologue.
There were
no breaks.
There were no cuts in there, were there?
No, not at all. And it would have been a single continuous take all the way through, except they had some problems with her breaking the staff. It was supposed to be able to break away, and they finally had it almost sawed in half before it actually worked right. If you watch closely her face when the staff breaks, she almost almost cracks a smile.
Oh, wow. I'll have to look at that.
Again, go back and listen to the commentary. That's where I learned this. Ah. But yeah, the Warrior cast is going to sit out the fight. Sheridan, very human moment.
Yeah.
His first concern in the, while he gives his orders, gets everyone working, and then he turns his attention to make sure his parents are safe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, his dad is supposedly a simple farmer, but you notice apparently he was also a diplomat at one time, and with as much as he knows about what's going on, he seems to still have some contacts.
Yeah, and he has cool, too.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's not rattled, despite all this stuff that's going on, and he knows what's going on. He's just, you know, hey, everything's going to be cool. You can do what you need to do. I have faith in you. You will do the right thing.
You look at him and you see middle America.
Yeah.
Just speaking as an old Southern Illinois boy, you're seeing middle America. Right down to his comment about never start a fight, but always finish it.
Yeah, well, it may have been that way 25 years ago, but here in middle America, I don't see that anymore.
Maybe not as much in Nebraska, but you certainly do see more of it than you might realize down here, at least in Southern Illinois. But Southern Illinois is almost more of the South than anything. Right next to Kentucky, right next to Tennessee, right next to the southern half of Missouri.
Ah.
But you have a comment about one of his dad's comments to him.
Oh, yeah. He says, you've always done the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's quite an endorsement.
And it does tie back to some of the things that JP has said about the decision-making process that he's having to go through.
Yeah.
It's a great call to action.
Yes.
Sheridan's announcement. Well, he chooses to break away too.
Yeah.
And I guess part of what he's having to ask himself is, in the big picture, which way is causing less death? And mm-hmm. I know we've had a lot of clips this episode, but there's one, well, at least more than one more, but there's another that definitely needs to be played, and that's Sheridan's speech.
All right, everyone, listen up. The commander and I have prepared a response to the unconstitutional actions taken against us and the Mars colony by President Clark. Is Drawl's holographic system online?
Just finished. Stand by for scan. You're online. Go ahead.
May I have your attention, please? In the last few hours, we have learned that warships are coming this way from Earth. Their orders are to seize command of Babylon 5 by force. As commanding officer and military governor of Babylon 5, I cannot allow this to happen. President Clark has violated the Earth Alliance Constitution by dissolving the Senate, declaring martial law, and personally ordering the bombing of civilian targets on the Mars colony. He is personally responsible for the deaths of hundreds of innocent people. Following these attacks, Orion 7 and Proxima 3 have broken away from the Earth Alliance and declared independence. Babylon 5 now joins with them. As of this moment, Babylon 5 is seceding from the Earth Alliance. We will remain an independent state until President Clark is removed from office. At the end of this current crisis, anyone who wishes to leave for Earth is free to do so. Meanwhile, for your own safety, I urge everyone to stay in your quarters until this is over. That is all. Well, we're in it now.
Should we ask Drawl to help with the defense?
No, he's our ace in the hole. I want to keep him a secret as long as we can. This is our fight, not his. All right, anyone who wants to leave, do so now, before you violate any regs.
Yeah. We're in it now.
And someone does leave.
Yes. Well, at least one person we see takes off the headset.
You know, my comment on this was, how do you make a decision like that on the one hand? But then our conversation earlier, you know, there's two Sheridans here. There's Sheridan, the military commander, with those obligations. And then there's Sheridan, the basically colonial governor.
And he invokes both.
Yeah, you're right.
As the military commander and, or what do you say, as commander and military governor, I can't let this happen. Mm-hmm. And then he cites the Constitution, says Clark's actions are unconstitutional. So now there's no guessing on anybody's part the view he's taking. He cites his authority based on the Constitution and lawful orders, not just orders, given to him by the assassinated president.
Yeah.
And confirmed by the Senate, which, by the way, is essentially, there are things being mixed here based on the real world, but lawful orders are given by those who are in your legal chain of command. And we've seen that come up in the show already. And senior officers are all, just to hold the rank that they hold, are confirmed by the Senate. And then he's implying as well, apparently, that back to a constitutional form of government and a military that's subordinate to civil authority, that there is a check and balance on the president in the form of the Senate. So he's citing all of government and saying...
The Senate that Clark dissolved illegally?
The Senate that Clark dissolved, right. Which in itself, if that constitution looks like ours, and everything about the show seems to suggest that it does, he has built a case in his own mind, had his therapy session with his dad, I think, just to get some peace or to center or whatever you want to call it. And then he comes out and he makes this announcement. And he's done it at the point that there is now a real threat, not a supposed threat, to the station and to his authority and to the Constitution.
So he builds both a legal case and a moral case.
Right.
Well, he cannot in good conscience allow this to go any further.
Right.
You know, he has a large, large population. He is responsible for their safety.
Right. And it's bigger than Earth.
Yep.
From where he sits. Not more people, but his jurisdiction, which he's governing over, appointed lawfully by the government of the Earth, is bigger than just the Earth. So he had all that to wrestle with. And then, by the way, I like that he gives crew a chance to leave. Very different than Clark, right? And I thought I didn't listen to the commentary, so I don't know if it came up in there, but I like the comment that he makes. Not that you can leave because it's scary or whatever. You can leave so that you don't violate any regs. Now, he just made a case for his position as being the most correct or the most legal or and you could argue, the most moral. So, and I thought, what a strange choice of words. Hey, if you don't like this and you want to leave, you can leave now so that you don't violate any regulations. And all I could think of was, now he's talking as a military officer. I've given you what I believe to be a lawful order. And if in the middle of the fight that's coming, you do something like choose to disobey, you show cowardice in front of the enemy, that's what's going to cause your problem. So if you think you need to leave, go ahead and leave now. We never learned what he meant when he said, so you don't violate the regs. But that's what went through my mind, is when you're actually faced with your brother at the other end of your rifle, your cousin, your neighbor, the people whose kids you know, the people whose wives you know, all of the things we talked about earlier. And then you say, I'm not going to follow the orders I've been given. That's going to be a problem. So he's told them what they're going to do. And he's giving people a very beautiful, a wonderful chance to say, I can't. But do it now before the fight begins.
Would a good commander do that? If God help us, if something like that came up in reality?
I would hope. And I think we have instances of it in the Civil War where people elected not to fight for any number of moral reasons. And he doesn't question the guy that walks out. Hey, wait, okay, you're leaving. Why are you leaving? He just lets the guy go. I think he wants people to mean what they're about to do, just like he means what he's about to do.
But he's made his case for his moral and legal authority.
Right. And that's the big note that I said I had to tie this back to the last episode, because I had mentioned it there at least once, and I think several times. There is a thing that we teach our officer trainees in the Air Force, officer candidates, and some of the other services about the authority of a commissioned officer and how chains of command work, what your legal authority is, and all of these things. And oftentimes Vietnam, not only Vietnam, but cases out of Vietnam are used as examples where orders by a legal commander, somebody commanding legally, were given that were unlawful. And that you can't just say later when you have committed some sort of an illegal act, well, I was just following orders. And your ability inside of the law to disobey, and there could be severe consequences for doing it at the moment, but the hope and the assumption is that the law being bigger than the commander will ultimately sort it out well as you exercise what's called moral authority. Lieutenant, shoot that civilian in the head. Sir, they didn't do anything wrong. I know, but they're annoying me. Kill them. No, sir.
Loot that
I'm
store.
Giving you an order. I got it. I can't execute your order because it's not lawful. Hey, Sergeant, lock the lieutenant up. That might happen. But the lieutenant is doing the right thing in this academic construct because the lieutenant is saying the law is bigger than you, sir. Hey, Mr. President, says Sheridan, the Constitution and my authority under it is bigger than your personal whim to hold a coup. I'm not going to participate. And there could be very awful consequences for that. So that's the thing, at least in part, but I think it's a big thing that JMS was probably getting at for whatever motives were in him for writing all of the parts of the show. But moral authority raised its head a few times in the last episode, and now we get this huge case, this huge example of a guy exercising moral authority. And he's telling everybody what he's doing and why he's doing it. And he's saying, if you can't stand with me, I understand, then step aside. He could have done a Clark, right?
Yeah.
If you don't like what I'm telling you, report to the brig or I'll have you jailed. But he doesn't do that. He says, if you can't do this, then step aside so that you don't violate any regulations. Yeah, that's a huge thing that stood out to me. If I was still teaching at the academy, I would probably find a way to use scenes from the last episode and this episode building up to that speech as an example of an officer demonstrating moral authority.
Wow. You just answered all of the questions that I could have possibly asked about this piece here and its appropriateness. With just that last comment.
The first time I saw the episode, I was standing on my feet. I couldn't sit still. I couldn't sit. I came out of my chair as this unfolded.
Oh, wow.
Because I couldn't believe a civilian had captured this so well, this problem that hopefully, well, I think most, at least in the American military, most people never face. Really, truly. But we teach officers about it and hope that they do the right thing if it ever comes to that. And to see a civilian capture this and put it in a show, a crazy, awesome example of moral authority. And you can take it out of the military context and say this is why historically the good and the best examples of civil disobedience happened. You can't do that. Why not? Well, because the law says, and the person civilly disobeys because they are essentially appealing to a greater law. But JMS did a great job of catching that. I don't know how he did it. I would love to sit down with a guy and say, what happened in your life or what did you see that you could unfold this amazing picture in a couple episodes. It's fantastic.
I don't know. Maybe check the credits and see if there is a military advisor on right. staff.
I don't know. But one thing I do know is what he does do, just, you know, as a student of history, that thinking goes all the way back to the Declaration of Independence. What JP describes is why the Declaration was written, to make that case, not just for legal, but also for moral authority, the whole concept of just war.
Right. And that goes, as you know, well back before.
Indeed.
Modern times, it goes back at least to Augustine,
mm-hmm.
which we also teach our cadets. So I hope that brings you some peace of mind when you know that these sorts of nuggets get put into our officers' heads when they're trained.
Yeah. It puts in peace of mind on one hand, and it doesn't surprise me on the other. Just from knowing the people that I've known that have served in the military and the level of integrity they have, it helps explain them a little bit better. I'll put it that way.
Right.
Right down to the idea, and I know this is a slight jump ahead, that Sheridan's prohibition against firing first. And you've also answered the question, why would the crew follow Sheridan?
Right.
No, he's just. Of course they're going to follow him.
Now, I do have one question, JP. Susan's insistence on being out there, going out there with the, you know, she's obviously, you know, a qualified fighter pilot.
Right.
Would someone of her rank actually do something like that, or is that just a Hollywood moment?
No, I think it's reasonable. It's a reasonable thing to put into the story, consistent with her personality, and in now B5 is huge, but as a squadron commander, for example, mm-hmm. I command a unit of a certain size, and I have a direct, and I'm using Air Force terms here, I have in my squadron a guy or a gal that's called a director of operations. They work for me, but their job is to make sure that the unit performs its operational purpose. They're the director of operations. And in the case of the unit that I commanded, I would have been surprised if my DO, my director of operations, didn't do something like that. Okay, game's on. I need to be out there leading from the front. I'm the director of operations. And it's, there's no right or wrong there. It's just, you know, the commander would have to decide, can I risk my second in command essentially being out there in the fight? Or do I need you back here? Or do I need you back here initially? And as the fight turns, I'm going to employ you to, you know, to beef up the troops or a flank. There's so much here that right. just can't be told in the story, but her reaction, her request didn't surprise me at all.
And that takes us to what turns out to be, at that point, quite literally the most ships in space on screen ever at that time.
So you're saying the 6 hours is up.
Huh?
The six hours is up.
Is up. Yeah.
Yeah.
There is the conversation. Sheridan makes his case against regarding his actions, and the Roanoke basically just switches off comms and goes hot. Watching that battle as it begins, I've got a 50-inch plasma. There's no ghosting. The response is incredible. It makes you dizzy with the ships flying in all directions and turning in all angles.
Oh, yeah. And let's not forget the fight that's going on with Michael.
Yes.
And
because the Marine,
his troops and the Narn that have stepped up and volunteered.
Yep, right. Because the Marines are bringing in a breaching pod, so the ground battle is coming as well. It's not just a typical fight in space.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I thought it was interesting the way that they showed in particular the Narn, who were seemingly lined up one after the other and getting gunned down one after the other. I mean, there was a long, they dwelled on that for quite a while in that scene.
It was horrendous. Do you remember the movie Gallipoli?
Yeah.
Yeah. I know it wasn't a matter of them being ordered to attack the machine gun positions. And obviously there was no one in the Narn that turned and ran, but just that charge into that fire, for some reason, it brings that kind of the heartache of Gallipoli to mind for me.
Yeah.
But for me, the real emotional turning point is Captain Hiroshi and the Churchill. And God, this is what really sells the whole episode more than anything else, because the Churchill is in bad shape.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we've lost communication with them.
It's crackling, yeah. And their call is to abandon ship. At least that's what Sheridan's yelling to her. And apparently she doesn't consider that to be a possible option at this point. And
yeah. Let alone there doesn't seem to be enough time. Mm-hmm. It's you know, do or die now.
Yeah, and you can see the ship on fire burning up. So, yeah, no time left. And in that last moment, she rams the Roanoke, and I don't cry at anything I see on television very often, but that brought a tear to that. I shed a tear or two when that happened, and Anthea still cries every time. That's why it was so important, I think, for Hiroshi as far as selling it, because that, and this connects to what JP was saying about the moral authority, because that pulls the story and his moral authority with real consequence, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, and these are people that are doing what they believe is the right thing to do. They're not going to shirk their responsibilities or put their morals behind them.
Mm-hmm.
They are going to move forward.
Yeah. The station wins this battle, at least that we think at this moment, that's the battle. Mm-hmm. But at what cost?
Oh, there's a huge cost, and there's more coming.
Yeah. The cost suddenly gets increased even more because, as you said, round two, another three ships.
Yeah.
Right when you sigh and think, okay, it's over, that was horrible, it's not over.
It's not over.
No. You know, and the same ultimatum, you know, lay down your arms and surrender. And this is where they mention Night Watch,
mm-hmm.
isn't it? Where, you know, you will surrender to the authority of President Clark and the Night Watch.
Yeah.
So as JP pointed out earlier, by expelling the Night Watch from the station, that's what prompted Clark to take action against the station preemptively, or to try to take it preemptively.
And it provides the legal proof of Sheridan's moral decision and legal decision. Mm-hmm. But if it's not bad enough, four more ships show up literally right on top of them. And look on Sheridan's face, the crushed look of defeat at that point, is painful.
Well, see, and that's what I thought too. First time I watched this, it was like, oh, geez, now what? You know, four jump points right on top of us. We're getting four jump points. And it was like, oh, gosh, this is over. But it actually wasn't.
Clark. Captain. Jump points forming right on top of us.
How many?
Four.
This is Ambassador Delenn of the Minbari. Babylon 5 is under our protection. Withdraw. Be destroyed.
Negative. We have authority here. Do not force us to engage your ship.
Why not? Only one human captain has ever survived battle with the Minbari fleet. He is behind me. You are in front of me. If you value your lives, be somewhere else.
That piece of line, as far as I'm concerned, puts D'Lynn right there square with Ripley and Sarah Connor.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
That's probably one of the most powerful lines in sci-fi, in my opinion.
Yeah. And then, now, knowing that the Minbari came within a hair's breadth of winning the war, the Earth ships say, okay, that's enough. We're done. And they take off.
They don't have quite the arrogance or false belief that Clark seems to have.
Well, you know, I guess they aren't willing to sacrifice themselves at this point. They're outnumbered. They're outgunned. And, you know, here's the White Star coming. They've never seen a White Star before.
And four Minbari cruisers.
Yeah.
That high, however, is kind of contrasted with what I can only call a flashback to the episode Gropos.
Yeah.
With the carnage of the Marine battle. It was ugly.
Yeah, they have a lot of casualties on the station, and then we get to hear a percentage of the Star Furies that are destroyed, too, which was significant. 30%, I think, was the number.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a huge number.
Yeah. Well, Civil Wars are always the bloodiest, at least through history. One piece of note there, just as a bit of a tribute to Jerry Doyle, in filming the battle, he actually broke his arm. And if you look, this is the kind of trooper he was. If you look when Zach is bringing him over and setting him down, you know, he's got his helmet under his arm.
Right.
Watch his arm. It moves it in a midpoint where there is not normally a joint for an arm to move. Once you actually seen it, you've seen it, though. I'm going to warn you in advance. You will not be able to watch it again without wincing. Because the pain in his face when he sits down and that helmet slips out, that pain in his face is absolutely 100% real.
Well, you know, and when I watched that, I was not aware of this, but I could see that something was not right with Jerry Doyle. And that was more than acting going on there when Zach was helping him.
Yeah. And they were actually going to not do that particular piece of the scene or do it differently. And Jerry wanted it to go. He wanted the scene to go because he wanted to get the drama, the impact of the story through. But yeah, 30% casualties on the fighters.
And we finally get the breath, even though it it ends with Allied tragedy. You know, maybe tragedy is too big a word, but and that breath we thought we got before, we get to take it finally. And then Sheridan and the Major meet, I guess, to lick wounds and kind of assess where they are.
Right. And the Major's going to continue on the run. Sheridan's taking on part of Hiroshi's crew, which actually not only gets him back to full strength, but with some of the upgraded fighters, it actually leaves him in a better position, militarily at least,
right,
than he was in before.
Yeah.
Well, I was saying, they do something that from last episode that Night Watch didn't know or understand or practice. You remember last episode, the demise of Night Watch was because they all went to the same place at the same time, right? Based on deception. They didn't divide themselves up or have second waves or anything. They all went. And here we see Sheridan and the Major splitting apart based on the logic that they're both targets now. So they are purposefully dividing their force so that it's harder to wipe them out.
Yeah, and, you know, not necessarily explicitly, but I think more evolutionally, we're starting to see, I mean, Sheridan, in a way, especially with this and dealing that defeat to Clark, is kind of becoming the center point or the lead of this whole resistance. I don't want to quite call it a revolution necessarily yet, but it's like he kind of takes the place of Mars in that respect. And I like the touch with Sheridan not being comfortable with his uniform at this point.
Yeah. And what I think I remember when the comment he made when the uniform comes up about I'm not comfortable putting it back on, meaning that he intends to put it back on. And it tracked with me back to his Declaration of Independence when he said, we're independent of the Earth until President Clark is removed. So he's not saying we're no longer Earth or we're not supportive of everything that was Earth. He's saying we're still a part of that. We're not going to play ball anymore until the problem is fixed. So that was neat. I'm not going to put this uniform back on until...
Right.
Yeah. We're not going to follow illegal orders.
Though we're going to find out later, it's like, you know, there's always consequences to actions.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, gentlemen, we are coming up really close to almost 2 hours of discussion.
Which will probably, and probably only about 30 minutes will end up on the cutting room floor. I'm going to make a wild guess. But that's okay because we are coming into, you know, okay, it's a bit of a Hollywood ending, all right? But with the power of these last three episodes, by God, they earned it. Straczynski, the cast, the crew, everyone. They earned a bit of a Hollywood
ending. I think we earned
the
ending. I don't mean we on the podcast. I mean viewers. That was a ride.
Yeah. Amen to that. Three-episode roller coaster. Remember, when that aired, it was 3 weeks.
So what is this Hollywood ending, Raul? What happens that we're all now beaming about?
The big round, the DeLynn and Sheridan moment as their relationship takes the new level. But then we've got something to show you and the huge round of applause. That's pure Hollywood, but my God, it was justified, I think. And that final focus on the Night Watch poster behind them. Can you think of it is a clear message that it's not over yet.
Right.
Oh, no.
And it is a perfect bookmark to that ending of season two, where we also have the focus on the Night Watch poster not ripped up.
Right.
Yeah. So, Jim, as you said, we went long, but wow.
Yeah. Well, and this episode deserves it.
Mm-hmm.
It justifies it. There is so much going on here that we couldn't have done it justice in 60 minutes.
No. So I'm hoping that our listeners and our editor, Troy, will forgive us.
I think we're in good shape.
But yeah. Well, folks, I think I've said everything that I could possibly say at this point, somewhere at some point during our discussion. Do either of you have anything else to add?
No, sir.
There is one scene that we did overlook, and that is when Londo was trying to get on the transport, and the Narn guard was blowing him crap about, hey, you're going to have to wait over here a couple hours before we can let you on.
Londo says, but you know who I am. And he says, I know who you are, but this computer doesn't know who
you are. That was, I think, the only actually comic moment in this entire episode.
Uh-huh.
Oh, God.
Yes.
Oh, any last thoughts or comments from you, JP?
No, sir.
Well, I am going to say welcome aboard again. And you know what? We've been talking about this, I think, since season one, Jim?
In and out? It's been... We waited way too long.
I know.
But I'm glad it's finally done.
I think he was busy or had a lot of things going on at the time. I don't remember exactly.
I know
we had hinted around it, you know, with the anytime you want to come on, more, please, welcome to it.
Yeah. I think though that, JP bringing you on, is going to raise the bar.
Well, thanks.
Quite considerably.
Absolutely. It has every time he has been on.
Yes.
Oh, well, I'm going to have to decide after this long of a show, am I going to go up and eat dinner now? Or am I going to search around and try and download some Borodin and Klee?
Well, you know what? That's not the real question. The real question here is, did we have any boom today?
Oh, a hell of a lot of boom today. And if you think that was boom, just wait, because there's probably going to be even more boom tomorrow. Why? You get it, JP.
Because there's always boom tomorrow.
Darn right.
Rock on.
Spot on. And you notice Susan with her Russian pessimism that brought that up. So my mentioning of the Russian Five was a perfect segue there, Jim.
There good we catch. Go.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
So long now.
Podcast terminated.
Thank you for listening to the Babylon Project podcast. You can email Raul and Jim at the Babylon Project podcast at gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook at the Babylon Project podcast. On the internet, we are at babylonprojectpodcast.wordpress.com. To subscribe to the podcast, you can find us on iTunes, or you can subscribe to the RSS feed on the webpage.